It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let's begin it together in song.
Service was generated from an idea that I have pondered for a long time now. Being aware that the history of our religious tradition is one that has had an evolving series of orthodoxies, and that those orthodoxies have always excluded certain persons or views, I've wondered whether there could be an orthodoxy which was more inclusive, and if so, what form that orthodoxy would take. By that, I mean to say, around what center could all of humanity gather and agree that the center is more important than any one radius that might be drawn from it? I believe that it's important to identify what it is that brings us together and keeps us together. I believe that if we remain focused on that, then we can deal openly and honestly with each other, even when we disagree. The world is full of ideas that can be both attractive and seductive, but are not in the long run healthful or life-giving. They do nothing to build us up, to make us better people, or add to our lives. In fact, many of them can drain our energy and leave us more cynical. We may exercise freedom of belief, but we are not protected against the negative impact of bad belief systems. And so we need to be very critical of the things that we believe, and we need to demand that the beliefs and ideas that we serve also serve us. I'll be speaking to you again in a month or so during a service on transcendentalism, and I will try at that time to express a little bit more about my own personal religious beliefs. But today I wish to speak to you about what I would like our community to be. And the best way I can think to do that is to tell a little bit of my own history with this church, the tradition from which I come, why I left that tradition, and what I have found here. You'll probably be familiar to most of you, and especially after Mark's words, and I promise that Mark and I did not coordinate on this. I was brought up in the Church of Christ, which is in some ways the polar opposite of Catholicism, and in other ways very similar. For those of you who aren't familiar with the Church of Christ, I would only say this. It is as fundamental as fundamentalism can get, and as narrow in its teaching as any church could ever be. It is a church that insists on both orthopraxy and orthodoxy. One must do the right thing, and one must do it for the right reasons, which are, of course, the reasons that they give. My parents are both simple, loving, God-fearing people who believe with complete earnestness all the things that they taught me. They practice more than they preach, and I respect them more than I can say, even though I disagree with them totally on matters of theology. I know that their love and respect for me is equally strong, even though they no doubt wonder how this tree-hugging gay agnostic could possibly be the product of the upbringing they provided. It was, I believe, at about age 12 that I began to think that I didn't believe the theology that I had been spoon-fed from the cradle. And by the time I left for college, I was certain of it. I never rejected or abandoned the orthopraxy, but only the orthodoxy. I never lost sight of the values that my religious upbringing had instilled in me. Those values have served me well in life, and I embrace them wholeheartedly. But for over 20 years, I never dreamed of going to a church. I know that many of you have heard this story more times than you care to remember. But when I came to this church, I came for one reason and one reason only, and that was to do Tai Chi. Once I got here, I began to get to know the people, and I began to read postings on the bulletin boards and to get some sense of the variety of beliefs and the diversity of thought that was embraced here. There was a class given that compared the principles of Taoism and the principles of Yuyuism. And so I attended that class for 10 consecutive Sunday mornings. And I listened to the people, and I engaged in the conversation, and I began to wonder what a service at a church like this would be like. And so I attended a service, and when I did, I was moved in a way that's hard for me to explain, but the feeling was one of keen awareness, an awareness of the organic whole of which we are all a part, and a feeling of belonging. I continued to come and to explore what this church has to offer. The more I explored, the more deeply I was drawn into this community. I find here a community of support and encouragement, of thoughts that challenge and challenges to thoughts. It is a community that helps me to grow and gives me grounding. This is the community of which I partake, and this is the community that I wish to help build up, to maintain and to see flourish. I want this community to be a welcoming place for all who seek in earnest, and a home to all who wish to share in our vision. I hope that each of you will join me in making it such a place.
Of our service and the center of our lives, let us make room for some of the quieter moments of life. You may use these moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly remembering who you are and why you are here. Those who love us best will be answered. Our best friends pray that we will be people of good character. They hope we will hold ourselves to high standards and welcome constructive criticism when we stray. Let us hope their prayers are answered. Those who care about what is best in us pray that we will honor what is best in us. They hope we will listen to the angels of our better nature, not the angels of our lesser selves. Let us hope their prayers are answered. And those close to us know, as we also do, that what we really believe, the gods we really serve, will be judged by our actions, whether noble or ignoble, loving or mean. And they hope and pray, those who love us best, that we will serve and be defined by those angels of our better nature. That's how we know they love us best. Let us pray that their prayers are answered. Amen. I don't often get to mention or even have any reason to mention my favorite philosopher, Ludwig Wittgenstein. He once cautioned a student not to get too familiar with sacred things, to grant them a respectful distance. And he would do that in part because there's a spirit about sacred things, and while you think you're playing with them, they may take your measure. I was reminded of this again, both by the sermon topic, but also by two current events in the news in the past 2 weeks. The first was the super-hyped release of Mel Gibson's movie on his peculiar version of the Passion. And the second was President Bush's equally embarrassing move to write discrimination and bigotry into the American Constitution for the first time in its history. And all these things have to do with the high cost and great risk of using sacred words. Words like God, country, justice, truth, and love, and using them in low or mean or inadequate ways. They will take the measure of us. As several movie reviewers have observed, Mel Gibson has made a movie about his own personal obsession with suffering. Most of his famous roles, Braveheart, Payback, Lethal Weapon, are obsessed with Mel Gibson's suffering in order to save people. His other obsession is with his very idiosyncratic version of Christianity. He's described kindly as a traditionalist Catholic. What that means, beyond the code language, is that he rejects Vatican II and all advances in Catholic thinking of the past 40 years, like the kinder and more gentler attitude toward Jews and people of other religions, or even translating the Mass into English so that believers can understand it. He's against all of that. He's even built a church near his home where he can hire a minister to preach religion the way he likes it. In a way, his movie raises him to the height of what must be his greatest fantasy, casting Jesus Christ to play Mel Gibson. One of the reasons it's dangerous playing with sacred things. Too many people notice. And as more and more religion writers are beginning to note, it's an embarrassingly narrow version of Christianity. He's very obsessed with picturing the goriest details of a torture that he did not get from the Bible, but he got instead from a book by a Catholic mystic of the 19th century, where she described in her own imagination those awful, horrible Jews and the horrendous wounds they inflicted on Jesus. It's that bigotry that he has taken as his inspiration for a movie, not anything noble from Christianity. This is America. He has the right to play with religious symbols and religious stories if he likes. He used $20 or $30 million of his own money to make the movie, and he has the right to do it. But he doesn't have the right to have his playing respected. That depends on how well he handles the religious symbols and the stories that he plays with, whether he gives them a high or a low meaning. And like Wittgenstein said, it's dangerous to get too close to sacred things. Because picking up powerful religious symbols and stories and metaphors is a little like a violinist picking up a Stradivarius. The instrument will take the measure of you and will let all with ears to hear know that you had no business handling something this fine. New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd, one of the more understated of our writers, saw the movie in a theater not even a quarter full, and she wrote an over-the-top review of the over-the-top picture. She said that it was like one of those spaghetti westerns directed by Sergio Leone in the 60s and 70s, that made Clint Eastwood famous. She described Gibson's film as a spaghetti crucifixion and suggested that its name could have been A Fistful of Nails. I suspect when the dust created by Gibson's own PR crew to stir up controversy to make sure the movie sells tickets, when that dust settles, I suspect the movie will disappear quickly from memory as a very bad movie with an embarrassing, even a silly, reduction of Christianity to his own fascination with physical suffering. Suffering, it's worth pointing out, that he's endured only as a movie actor with lots of special effect and makeup teams so he would feel no pain. Mel Gibson's simplistic and sensationalist treatment of Christianity is, I think, of the same kind and nearly at the same level as President Bush's treatment of America and his new political move toward a constitutional amendment to prohibit gay marriage. It is also, like Gibson's, an act showing no awareness of any advances in thinking over the past 40 years. Unlike Gibson's, it's a thoroughly political move. And then to see and hear Christians and Christian ministers coming forward in the media to say that their God hates gays and lesbians is even lower than a spaghetti crucifix. It's a betrayal, even a crucifixion of the Spirit of Jesus and of the highest Spirit that has been served by many, many, many of the best Christians in history. Some people think that you shouldn't hear things like this in church, that all sermons should be G-rated, even discussing an R-rated movie. That being religious means you only say nice things about everybody, even about very bad behaviors and the people who do them. Some people think that being religious means you never judge anyone. If they think that, they may not have read many religious scriptures. It's certainly not how it is in the Bible. The prophets in the Hebrew scriptures were always angry. Amos saw the rich selling the poor for silver and a pair of shoes, and he was outraged, and he said God was outraged. The prophets were angry whenever one kind of person thought his kind was superior to other kinds of people. Jesus did say at one point, "Judge not, and ye won't be judged," to stop people who were judging in simplistic ways, but most of what he said was very judging. He told the story about the Levite, the priest, who went to prayer, and the sinner who went to prayer at the same time, and how the Levite marched boldly to the center of the place and made a point of thanking God that he wasn't like that sinner. And the sinner, standing off at a distance, simply praying for forgiveness for one such as he. And Jesus said the prayers of the first were not acceptable to God. Don't tell me religion isn't about judging. It's about holding us to the very highest standards and not letting us off the hook when we fail to reach them. It's not damning us for reaching too low, but it's holding us only and always to the highest standards and having the courage to stand up for those standards. Orthodoxy means right beliefs. To claim to have right religious or patriotic beliefs, we have to let those high symbols pull us up to their level and never drag them down to ours. America's gone through other low points in its history where many citizens, probably always a majority in each case, have discriminated against blacks, women, Irish, Italians, Catholics, Jews, gays, lesbians, and others. We have all often taken the counsel of the angels of our lesser natures. When we look back on these times, we do not do it with pride. We do it with shame, because we know that at those moments we degraded our high ideals, and the spirit of those high ideals judged our behaviors as low and mean. We played with ideals at the level of a Stradivarius, and they took our measure. We're talking about character. That's what the word orthopraxy is really about. behaving in ways worthy of people of character. And when we speak about character, we value the same things people in all times and places have cared about. Honesty, integrity, authenticity, moral courage. Questions of character aren't fancy. They're very ordinary sorts of questions that extend our horizon beyond the biases of our little in-group to reconnect us through our common humanity with all people. And in our efforts to live like people of character, some of the best teachers we have are our highest ideals, those sacred words and things, whether they're religious, civic, or personal. We could not grow to be people of good character without the guidance and the challenge and the censure of words like God and country, truth and justice, love and duty. These are the words that both take our measure and build our character, and they are among the most sacred treasures any culture has, and we are all called to serve them. In the 3rd century, there was a brilliant Christian thinker who lived, a man named Origen, lived in Alexandria. He's always been one of my favorite religion writers, either of East or West. He studied with and succeeded Clement of Alexandria, probably the biggest giant in Christian thinking in the 2nd century. Clement let Origen take over because Origen was the only person around he knew who was capable of it. At the time, Origen was 19. By the time he died, he'd left behind over 1,000 titles. Not even Origen scholars have read them all. One of his instructions was in how to read religious scriptures, how to approach holy things. And he said when we do it, we must search always for 2 things at the same time. And they both have to be there. We search first for what is useful to us and what is worthy of God. Nothing lower. Nothing less. That's why it's dangerous to play with sacred words. That's what they demand of us. And we will be judged by failing to serve them well. This isn't the way nationalistic or religious language has usually been used through history. I know that as well as you do. Mostly, it's dragged down to the level of spaghetti crucifixions or a fistful of bigots. It's always happened that way. It made the prophets in the Hebrew Scriptures furious. It made Jesus angry. And now it's our turn to be angry when holy words are used in low, unimaginative, or mean ways. I don't think Jesus would take Mel Gibson's movie seriously enough to get angry. But I do agree that it might make him throw up. And if you're going to be a Christian, I don't think you should behave in ways that might make Jesus throw up. Being religious isn't about just being sweet and forgiving, any more than being a responsible citizen is just about waving a flag. Religion, citizenship, love, and the rest aren't about making it easier on ourselves. They're not toys. They're not soul candy. They're about raising the standards, playing by more demanding rules than we had to when we weren't claiming to be religious, patriotic, or loving. In the Hebrew Scriptures, all Jews were considered the children of God. He was their father. It was their covenant with him. But this never meant he let them off the hook or made it easier on them. It always meant he held them to higher standards than he held other people to. When you pick up sacred words, sacred teachings, sacred symbols, they will take your measure. That's what's great about them. It's what makes them sacred. You may think you can make a movie like a spaghetti crucifixion to reduce a noble, complex, loving religion to the level of your own personal obsessions, but you can't get away with it. You will be found out and exposed. You violated something sacred, and you will be called to account for it, even by prophets as unlikely as Maureen Dowd. Wittgenstein was right, I think. We should be very careful of claiming too much familiarity with sacred things. It's very dangerous, because they're not trinkets, and we may not use them however we please. They have a kind of spirit about them, and when we dishonor that spirit, others who see and understand it judge us for demeaning something we didn't have the right to demean. Don't get me wrong. I think we should try to define ourselves by our highest ideals, our noblest words, God, country, truth, justice, love, the rest of them. Holding a religious belief means we want to be judged by the highest standards. The poet Rilke once said that we are blessed by the ideals we pursue in earnest. We become what we worship, which is the danger of worshiping unworthy ideals or simplistic religious or national identities. I think this is hard to do. I fail daily at living by only the highest ideals, listening only to the angels of my better nature. I fail daily at it. Some of you may too. But to use noble ideals demands that we hold them to their highest level and try to reach that level ourselves. Nothing lower, nothing less. Because they will take our measure. And if orthodoxy means holding the right beliefs and orthopraxy means living by the highest values, we should want to be orthodox and orthoprax at a level that unites us with all that is common and noblest in all people, all people. We have to be sure they're the highest beliefs, not the lowest. And we have to keep asking when we find something that suits us or may be politically advantageous, whether it is worthy of God. Nothing less. Nothing less.